Please welcome Nelly Wong.
Hi, everyone. It's really great to be here. I was a student here in the 70s, believe it or not. And I only attended classes at night because I was working full-time as a secretary then. And then I got so busy and I never returned. So I'm a junior. Maybe I should come back. And I'm glad to be here to share the stage with Jenny Lim, who is someone I deeply respect and admire for her work and activism. And this is my first time in the Poetry Center, even though I came here for many years. Yes, I can't believe it. So thank you, Steve, for inviting us. And I'm glad you saw that announcement at Bird and Beckett. So now, is my voice coming through clearly for you? Okay, great. All right, so today I'm going to share some poems from several of the books that I've been published in and have published. And I'm really, really excited to be here. And I assume that most of you are poets and writers and interested in literature and how literature impacts our lives and how it's really tied in with political activism, how important that is. And I think that if I hadn't come to San Francisco State in the 70s, and if one of my professors didn't tell me that I shouldn't write angry poems, I might not be here. So I have to actually thank him for that kind of adverse remark. And many of my sister writers in other classes in feminist studies that I didn't have to listen to him, and I didn't know at the time because I was just really shy and really inexperienced in the ways of going to college and such, because I've worked ever since I was a teenager as an office worker, a secretary, administrative assistant. So much of my work also comes from that part of my life, and I was very happy to be here when I was, because the women's movement and Asian American studies and all the things that had emanated from, I think, the civil rights struggle as well as the fight for ethnic studies and women's studies and LGBT studies, Native American studies, etc., really helped to make a difference. So I'm here today with you, and thank you again for having me. When I am breathing, I want to write you a letter, but my love, I don't know why it is. Why it is, my love, but you can't read. And I, oh, the hopelessness, I can't write. Those are the words of Antonio Jacinto, letter from a contract worker in a book called When My Brothers Come Home, Poems from Central and Southern Africa. When I am breathing, I am writing. I braid my daughter's hair. I lift my breasts to my son's mouth. When I am writing, I am breathing. My sister and I herd sheep on this vast land, the sky bluer than ink I am able to buy. My fingers pick each bean from the pot of water. I hoist two buckets of water over my shoulders, and though they ache, I contemplate tomorrow, not knowing if it will arrive. The song in my heart is a brook, washing my body as I start the fire, glancing at my daughter, my son, crooning that their father will soon return. The rooster hops onto the bed. The orange cat nuzzles next to my youngest, her eyes following the rattle I shake. I oil my son's scalp, and the writing flows from my fingertips. Okay. I don't know what you all think about what they call, is it Black Friday after Thanksgiving, the day after? Or day of giving thanks. And when I read this, I was outraged. Consumed. Long Island, New York, Walmart employee, 39 years old, an African-American man, a temporary worker stampeded to death at 5 a.m. by 200 shoppers on Black Friday, day after Thanksgiving. Who's to blame? Walmart's lack of security? Many waiting all night for doors to open at the crack of dawn? Walmart's statement, though through unseen suits, send their prayers. Who's to blame? The economic crisis? People whose homes are being foreclosed? People who don't know if their next paycheck may be the last? People in frenzy to buy the flat screen TV, that Nintendo game, that iPod, that BlackBerry, that barbecue that will cook for hundreds, that North Face jacket, that rocking horse, that Armani knockoff, that pair of Nikes priced at inflated dollars. Who's to blame? Who's to blame? Who's to blame? The Dow down 680 points, the official U.S. in recession, the terrorists in Mumbai, the stores opening up at 5 a.m., Thanksgiving. I like to write poems on my birthday. I don't make every one of them, but this one would tell you what I wrote. And it's called Launching 62. Excuse me, I thought I had it. Sorry, I thought I had a tag, but I had another one tagged that I would like to share with you. This is called Flying. People might remember, some of you might be a little young, but when the students at Tiananmen Square in China were demonstrating at Tiananmen Square, and the soldiers came in and killed many of them, killed students and workers. So a friend and I had gone to an event to hear the speakers who were able to come to San Francisco, and they were the student activists fighting for democracy. Flying. Holding my arms out like wings of a bird, I walked the crack a straight line on the sidewalk. Heel to toe, heel to toe. Obedience now is a virtue. The early morning air engulfs me. The moon is hiding from my brown eyes, filled with intention, staying calm on this flight on Guerrero Street. Pivoting, still walking, heel to toe, heel to toe. Another order assails my ears, not turning up my hearing aid now, now. No movement, no movement that would provoke a bash on the head, verbal abuse, or handcuffs around my wrists. A captive student in jail on the street being told not to fly. Don't be a bird, I think. His badge shining in my eyes as he barks, just follow my instructions, just do exactly as I do. Cooperating is my forte. Right, left, right, left, left. He thinks I will make a mistake. He thinks that I will not know the difference between left and right, that my manner breathes intoxication, resistance. Yes, intoxicated with desire for democracy in a socialist China. Intoxicated for a woman's right to choose. Intoxicated with the strength of women warriors. Intoxicated for the right to speak a native language in the workplace. Intoxicated for freedom, roofs over the heads of the homeless. I fly yet keep my hands at my side, my eyes straight ahead, devouring his silver badge, knowing that a woman alone on the street is deep, a targeted enemy of bull's eye. A man walks by, watches my movement, watches my left hand touch the tip of my nose, watches my right hand touch the tip of my nose, left, right, left, right, left, left. Meanwhile, the other cop yells, "Don't you move until we tell you to." Undaunted, I reply, "You don't have to yell. I like talking back." Yes, left, left, the glass is half full. The night is a friend with no comrades in sight. Intoxication is breath, restless sleep, wakeful. A ribbon of red riding night dreams. The immediate goal is to fly, feel safe in my room, surrounded by pictures of family, wondering how it happened, being stopped for a running, a flashing red light, flashes of imprisonment, concrete walls, flashes of lights. This danger hovers over me. As I jump into my car, encountering another police car at the next intersection, hoping they will not notice this woman, flashing red, flashing left, left intent as a signal under a landscape, flying, flying with immense desire for freedom, flying, flying home. That was a scary thing. I've never been stopped by a cop before. And yes, my friend and I have been having a few beers with our dinner after listening to the Chinese activists who were at Tiananmen Square. So, that's part of my experience as an activist, being out there on the streets and studying as well and trying to understand what is going on when they claim hundreds, but probably thousands. And you might recall the man who alone walked out in front of a tank by himself. That was flashed all over the world. And today I think that it's not just human rights, but also the what the Chinese workers and students are fighting for tonight. And many of them are in jail, and many of them have scattered to live in other countries. But it affected me as a woman and as a Chinese American. I think in a lot of my work as someone who really didn't know or understand why I was writing, but why it was necessary. And I have to say that writing actually saved my life and took me out of what I consider like my private world. And I had known about the Vietnam War, watched it, didn't understand why, on television that is, and didn't know why I was not involved. But I think it has a lot to do with my upbringing and the thing that I am the daughter, firstborn daughter of Chinese immigrants, and the thing was to go to work, make money, and raise a family. That's what you're supposed to do. So I think also then in thinking about not appreciating, not liking, not valuing my own identity as a Chinese woman growing up in Oakland, California, and how I was influenced by the media, thinking that I should be white. When I was growing up, I know now that once I longed to be white. How, you ask? Let me tell you the ways. When I was growing up, people told me I was dark, and I believed my own darkness in the mirror, in my soul, my own narrow vision. When I was growing up, my sisters with fair skin got praised for their beauty, and I fell further, crushed between high walls. When I was growing up, I read magazines, saw movies, blonde movie stars, white skin, sensuous lips, and to be elevated, to become a woman, a desirable woman. I began to wear imaginary pale skin. When I was growing up, I was proud of my English, my grammar, my spelling, fitting in to the group of smart children, smart Chinese children, fitting in, belonging, getting in line. When I was growing up and went to high school, I discovered some rich white girls, a few yellow girls, their imported cotton dresses, their cashmere sweaters, their curly hair, and I thought that I too should have what these lucky girls had. When I was growing up, I hungered for American food, American styles, coated white, and even to me, a child born of Chinese parents, being Chinese, was feeling foreign, was limiting, was un-American. When I was growing up and a white man wanted to take me out, I thought I was special, an exotic gardenia, anxious to fit the stereotype of an Oriental chick. When I was growing up, I felt ashamed of some yellow men, their small homes, bones, their frail bodies, they're spitting on the streets, they're coughing, they're lying in sunless rooms, shooting themselves in the arms. When I was growing up, people would ask if I were Filipino, Polynesian, Portuguese. They named all colors except white, the shell of my soul, but not my rough, dark skin. When I was growing up, I felt dirty. I thought that God made white people clean. And no matter how much I bathed, I could not change. I could not shed my skin in the gray water. When I was growing up, I swore I would run away to purple mountains, houses by the sea with nothing over my head, with space to breathe, uncongested with yellow people in an area called Chinatown. In an area I later learned was a ghetto, one of many hearts of Asian America. I know now that once I longed to be white. How many more ways, you ask? Haven't I told you enough? My most recent book came out in 2012. It's called Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, and there's food all over the place. And so I know usually people would say, oh, Nelly, where's a good Chinese restaurant to eat? And I was always guiding my office mates and such where to eat. And then I thought, well, we do love to eat, love to cook. Although I didn't learn to cook until I got engaged and got a wok. the Chinese frying pan, and at the engagement party, my whole family was just laughing. They said, Nelly, what are you going to do with that? I'm going to cook, and I learned. But this is called Ironing, Ironing, and this is for Tilly Olson. I'm sure many of you know of her work. A powerful writer, working class, and I traveled with Tilly as one of the delegates to China in the 80s on that first women writers tour. And one of my jobs as a young girl was to iron for the whole family. Ironing, ironing for Tilly Olson. Like a drunken fool, I pick out the wrinkled linen shirt, the foam-green dress, the black long-sleeved tee, and I drink ice-cold glasses of lemon tea as the temperature lingers at 90-plus degrees. When I ironed as a 12-year-old, I listened to the radio. Imogene Coca and Sid Caesar battled in their boisterous humor. The Lone Ranger and his faithful companion Tonto rode in clouds of dust. But I liked his real name better. Jay Silverheels, the Inner Sanctum, the Whistler, and Jack Benny with his arms akimbo and with his sidekick Rochester. I can see Tallulah Bankhead, her heavily mascaraed eyes. I hear her deep-throated voice and smell her cigarette breath. These radio characters were good company as I ironed and ironed my father's pants, my mother's dresses, my sister's blouses, and my own pajama tops and bottoms that Mama sewed just for me. No, these were not PJs for sleeping. I felt shame because I was a girl and had to wear pants which were not in style. I wanted to wear flower print dresses with crisp Peter Pan collars like my sisters and girlfriends, but couldn't because my eczema had a field day with ripe red hives blossoming onto my skin, conquering the body that I thought I owned. When I was young, I thought that ironing was drudgery, only the work that poor Chinese and black girls did, not for pin money, but for money, period. When I ironed at midnight, Baba fried his golden pork chops in a wrought iron pan and drank his VO in our kitchen. He already worked a long day and evening at our Great China restaurant, and we became companions, father and daughter, staples in the kitchen, using our hands to cook and iron, silent with our unexpressed dreams. Marriage. Blurred Baba one night, and I said nothing. I only ironed and ironed, thinking the hissing of the steam iron was noisy enough for both of us. Now I practically dance as I iron, because I've had so much practice, retrieving from my woven Japanese basket the postcard reproduction of a painting called Ironing by Jacob Lawrence, who now resides with the world's dead poets. Dead painters. In the painting, three black women, tall, an angler in white cotton cloche hats and sleeveless white dresses, hunker down with heavy black irons. They had no steam irons, just their muscles and grit, finishing up some mistresses, blouses, aprons, and tablecloths. They dig and lift, push and slide and lift again. Their thoughts submerge into the irons as their fingers maneuver on the ironing boards as expertly as ice skates on a ring. This ironer, this word has dignity. Ironed on hot nights, nice cold mornings, doing the work their white employers paid them little to do. Jacob Lawrence didn't paint the ironers' eyes, their noses, their mouths. I don't know if they were smiling or gossiping, if they were worried about the day's meager wages, if there was enough milk or cereal for their children. Technology cannot give us digital ironing. Who'd want it? You mean flicking a switch, pointing the arrow at an icon, and your ironing done? Astronauts swallowing pills for honey-baked ham and chocolate eclairs? Ironing is honest work. Ironing is what Mama's brother-in-law from China did, a handsome laundryman we address as a champ, with his own laundry at the mouth of Stockton Street Tunnel entering Chinatown. Here, Chinese men ironed and pressed white linens, men's dress shirts, women's dresses, even rich folks' underwear. I probably will never stop ironing, even though it's smart to look wrinkled these days, savoring the rhythm, the honesty on this, the hottest night of the year. I stand here, ironing, ironing.
You. All right, I think a couple more here. How's my time?
You're good.
I'm okay? All right, great.
I've written a lot of poems about war. A friend and comrade of mine, Karen Brodine, who also came here to San Francisco State, and we were in some classes together, and she used to always say to me, "You have to write about work." I said, "Why? I'm only a secretary." And then she says, "Because it's important." So even though I have written a lot about work, I also, I think, am moved by what I hear and what I see. And as I told you earlier, when that same professor told me I should throw away my angry poems, I read another piece, and he said that, well, how can you really see that those were maggots on that man's head? So I wrote a piece also and said, well, I wonder if I should ever, maybe not, if I can't see it, I shouldn't write it down. Sounds in the night. The clock does not tick. It sings. La, la, la. The air conditioner hums, low, mournful. The night sky enters through the window, hides a chrysanthemum into my body. La, 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 la. Rhythms of the universe engage itself. Anemones and starfish float in the horizon, tucked between my ears. No bombs tonight in Baghdad, no bullets barraging above the head of Palestinians. A woman picks olives from the one tree left, not knowing the black-brown pit of a loquat is a close cousin. Children sleep in fits and starts while their fathers toss and turn. La, 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 la. A candle burns, a song lifts from the throat of a nightingale, while a paragraph forgets its purpose and intrusion. The sentences between us link your mouth to mine, but your eyes wander beyond my soul. Memory shifts from morning to night as light sparkles through the blinds, making appointments with forgetfulness. O clock, you swing back and forth, forth and back, a memory of moments arrayed in the turquoise sea of my aging body. Language scratches and snatches, cradles civilization toward a gaggle of geese. Chinese migrant workers, as many as 50 million, scratch for jobs on their land. Miserable, but there and here, a few grains of rice, the baby strapped to the back of a woman's body. La, 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 la. Seeking tenderness from the warmth of the July sun, but night descends, an apparition clothed in threads of gold silk, and toss you stars that float away in a river of cadence in the sounds of night. We are now in very, very terrible political times. Not that we ever aren't, when you think about what's happened. It's not only Trump being in office and such, but that the battles are everywhere in this world. And I think that one of the things, when I was coming to San Francisco State in the 70s, convinced me that I was taking the classes in literature and poetry and getting involved in the Women's Caucus in Creative Writing and Literature here, which were that they were fighting for inclusion of women and inclusion of people of color in the faculty and for more classes that were diverse, and how we were never see ourselves in literature, or not allowed to, because the student who was one of the organizers of the Women's Caucus in Creative Writing and Literature wanted to study Grace Paley and Tilly Olson for her orals, and she was turned down because these women weren't really part of the canon. They didn't have enough work. So another thing that I like to do often is, kind of throw poems at you when you just read the paper or listen to the news. So one day I read this headline, "A bad week for women in Japan. remarks of three male leaders revealing lingering undercurrent of discrimination. And this was an article written by a woman in the Associated Press, which appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle in 2003. Tokyo. A former prime minister says women who don't have children shouldn't get pensions. A senior ruling party lawmaker suggests gang rapes are normal behavior. Even the cabinet's top spokesman pipes up, saying women who dress provocatively invite rape. See what happens when Prime Minister Yoshio Mori and other senior political leaders debate how Japan should address its declining birth rate? The experts on the behavior of women speak out. Such clanging in our ears, such male noise, welfare is supposed to take care of and reward those women who have lots of children, Mori said. It is truly strange to say we have to use tax money or take care of women who don't even give birth once, who grow old living their lives selfishly and singing the praises of freedom. At least gang rapists are still vigorous, replied former cabinet minister Seiichi Ota, when the debate's moderator then referred to recent high-profile cases of gang rape allegedly involving students at several prestigious universities. The problem is, there are lots of women dressed provocatively, said Yasuo Fukuda, minister in charge of gender equality. Mr. Fukuda, off the record, of course, told reporters at a briefing that the real culprits in gang rape, da-da, were women. Thank you, gentlemen, for speaking out your true thoughts. No wonder fewer women in Japan continue to have children. Welfare is not such a wonderful incentive. Ever think of offering a vault of gold? No wonder women who don't even give birth once live their lives selfishly, singing the praises of freedom. Never mind the fact that some women are unable to have children, or they should have such a choice. Really, such audacity, such daring, such original thinking. And oh, those women who choose not to have children, why, just send them off with their own cell phones to a desert island. No wonder women wear low-cut t-shirts with their belly buttons showing. Shame, shame, no wonder boys join gangs. Gang rapes represent their vigor, their virility, such enlightenment. So what if it's at the expense of women? No wonder headlines about fighting for women's equality the world over appear now and then. If you look hard enough, good luck. Gender equality. Maybe it's just not sexy enough issue. Maybe this gang of politicians just got to be boys. Okay. Right, a couple more, and then we'll hear Jenny, and I'm pretty much a film nut, and grew up in the movies and reading magazines, and I even, when my father died and my mother was alone for a while, but we always went to the movies, and I dragged her to all the theaters and see a lot of international films. But this one I saw was called Kandahar. Everybody knows where Kandahar is, Afghanistan. And when the U.S. government was starting to invade and bomb Afghanistan, there was an article in Newsweek that talked about a film called Kandahar, so I ran to see it. So this poem is based on that film, Kandahar, My Eyes Follow Them. My eyes follow them, women in burqas of gold, cream blue, burgundy, women unseen traveling to a wedding party to somewhere in Kandahar. How do I know they are women, except that only women wear burqas? Covered from head to toe with squares of opening, netted or crocheted, framing their eyes, and even in their embroidered beauty, the intricate stitching of the covers over their heads do not distract. My eyes follow them. Children in cotton and colors of birds, their eyes fixed on the unseen viewer. Their eyes follow the camera aimed at their foreheads, throats. The girls are not covered up like their grandmothers, mothers, aunts, until one day as they approach womanhood. Then too, they will wear burqas. Then too, they will remain invisible. And still, my eyes follow them. A woman hands a lipstick to her sister and runs a slash of berry red across her unseen lips, because in their burqas to these watching eyes, beauty blossoms. Beauty blossoms in secret salons, in homes where women carry out rituals, who teach girl children to read Arabic, who resist the law handed down by men demanding invisibility as their right. My eyes follow them. The men hobbling on one leg, their crutches become wings as they rush in unison toward a helicopter, dropping prosthetics and pair floating from parachutes, dropping onto the land, dry and barren, when one thump or hop could explode a landmine. My eyes follow the woman, a journalist named Nafas, in her burqa, disguised as the fourth wife of a man who rides with his family ostensibly to Kandahar. Nafa searches for her sister whose legs have been blown off, left years ago in Kandahar, who has threatened to kill herself rather than live under control of the Taliban. My eyes follow them, the woman surrounded by her children whose hunger gnaws at a sandwich made of grass. The father knows it's only a matter of time as winter descends over the land, as tons of wheat are hoarded by warlords, that death may be a gift, that death may be better than starving. These eyes absorb, penetrate, these eyes remember the bound feet of my aunt in Oakland's Chinatown. This woman whose movement was restricted from her girlhood in China all the way to the United States. These eyes ferret the unknown, the hidden, the unseen faces, shapes of their jaws, mouths, arms, bodies, legs of the women in burqas, whose passion for movement remain unknowable, whose spirit thrive at the thought of wheat they could pound into flour, who long for the sun to find them unafraid and daring to read the newspapers, listen to the radio, watch television, walk the streets, run the land, dancing as women, as sisters, beckoning in the heart of darkness as the eyes split open, their ankles glistening with truth. Okay, let's do this. This is my final piece for tonight, and I'm always thinking about food, shopping, cooking, and preparing it, and loving making art out of food at the same time, and understanding too how we get our food and the struggles of migrant workers who pick our strawberries and our lettuce and everything else, and how much of them are being deported among the other kind of work that they do to help build this country and to survive. This is instrumental rhythm. Cooking sweet and sour rock cod, playing cool jazz, yeah, whether tenor saxophone or trumpet, pat the fish dry, sprinkle salt and pepper, and the notes fly, syncopate. Pour oil into the wok, get it sizzling, place the whole cod into the concave body of the wok, and let it fry. Messengers of jazz in birdland. West tomatoes, sliced yellow onions, and green bell peppers collide in unison. Chamber music in wrought iron. Pour white vinegar, almost half a cup, mixed with granulated sugar. Dizzy Gillespie and Machito embrace in a blow of horn and samba. Dribble cornstarch paste like light rain, thicken the ensemble, crown the entire body with bubbling sauce. Off with apron, pour Pinot Grigio, clash the cymbals, serve the fish on an ice blue platter. Scoop steamed long grain rice into celadon green bowl. Sit down, let chopsticks do the dance, a finale that rocks, that never ends. Thank you very much.